This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I'm here with Deborah Holt Larkin, who is the author of A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. Debbie, thanks for being here with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Could you start by talking a little bit about this book and how it came to be, and maybe giving us a little information about why you decided to return to this story from the 1950s?
A Lovely Girl is the true story of Olga Duncan's abduction and murder in 1958, California. But it's also a memoir about me as a 10-year-old girl. I became obsessed with Olga's disappearance. And my father was a reporter for the paper. This crime occurred in my hometown, and he was a reporter for the paper, and he was the lead reporter to cover from the time of Olga's disappearance all the way through the trial and the execution of her killers. And he was an interesting guy. He was really kind of had no filter. And I heard all about this at home, asked many questions. And so anyway, I don't think obsessed is too strong of a word for my interest in this. When Olga Duncan disappeared, it was really a pivotal moment in my life because I was living 1950s. It was a more innocent time. We often think of that time as a more innocent time. And things like this just didn't happen in my hometown. So when she disappeared and then when her body was discovered, it was suddenly a wake-up call for me that, oh my gosh, you know, bad things can really happen here. And it sort of fed into my worst nightmares, the idea that someone could just, you know, disappear from their apartment and then be found dead later. So it's a book that weaves the story of Olga's disappearance, the investigation, the trial, weaves through the story of my 1950s life. I think that the memoir gives context to the story of the true crime procedural, and also the true crime procedural kind of gives you a little bit of context of what life in the 1950s was like. It's, you know, when I first was writing this book, people are always asking you, okay, well, what's your book about? Or, you know, and one of the things that I used to say was, well, it's Dave Barry meets Anne Rule in Fargo. And that really sort of touches on the fact that my dad was this columnist. He was writing a weekly column about, you know, a lot of things that were going on around town, but frequently kind of things going on in our family. It was a humorous column. And the Anne Rule part is, well, this is true crime. The Fargo is that this was a bizarre murder, and these killers were bumbling and brutal at the same time. So I think that I'm hoping that I answered your question. I'm trying to think. It was kind of had a number of things in it, but I could stop there. And then I could tell you just a brief bit, I guess, before we go on about Olga's tragedy. Olga was seven months pregnant. She was a registered nurse at a hospital in Santa Barbara. She was married to an up and coming local defense attorney. And at the time of her, they were married in June of 1958, and she disappeared in November of 1958. So she hadn't been married very long, and already Frank, her attorney husband, was no longer living with her at her apartment. He would visit occasionally, but he had moved back to live with his mother, who was extremely demanding and threatening to commit suicide if he didn't move back home with her. So the night that Olga disappeared, Frank was at home with his mom. And that night, Olga had invited a couple of her nurse friends from the hospital over, and they had refreshments and she was showing them the baby clothes that she made for her unborn child. And the friends left about 11:10, and Olga Duncan was never seen alive again.
So you start us and you sort of, we enter the story and you move back and forth between chapters, between your experience and sort of Olga's experience. And so you kind of set that up for us, right? This experience, this young woman who is hanging out with her friends and then all of a sudden disappears. And so you say your dad was a reporter and was sort of doing more columns about the family, sort of fun things. So could you talk a little bit about how your dad started to get involved with Olga's disappearance and then subsequently the trial for her murder?
Well, this was, I should have said too, that Olga lived in Santa Barbara, but the killers drove over the county line into Ventura County, and she was actually murdered in Ventura County. So it became a Ventura story because that was where they were charged. But anyway, this was the biggest story that had happened in both Santa Barbara and Ventura in a very long time. And my dad was the lead reporter for the newspaper, so he was assigned to the case. But he was also very interested in the case. It wasn't just a job for him. And so that's how he was assigned to to cover this case. He was the only reporter who was at every session of every trial for all three of her killers. So even afterwards, he became the local expert, and he talked about this for years. I have he used to refer to it as the remarkable Duncan case. So he also had an unusual parenting style, I think. He had no filter. And even though I was only 10 years old, I was reading the newspaper, and we had lots of newspapers in our home, not just the one that he worked for, but he would bring newspapers home from, big cities or whatever, and they were just sort of around the house. So I did, at 10, read the newspapers. I became very interested in this story. I identified with Olga. Oh my gosh, if this could happen to her, could it happen to me? And he was willing to talk to me about it. He would try to kind of discourage me. And my mother would say sometimes, "Oh, Bob, you're scaring the children." But, you know, he still talked about it around the dining room table. He would come home from the trial, and we would hear about some of the crazy goings on in that trial. And so also just what happened to Olga, it stuck with me my entire life. So when I wanted to write. I thought I wanted to write a mystery, a fictional book. And I would try to take this plot and somehow fictionalize it. But I have a lot of never finished books with just the first few chapters, because it was so hard to fictionalize, because honestly, it was stranger than fiction. And I didn't really believe that ultimately a publisher would, you know, buy this. It's kind of crazy that you have to write the story in nonfiction because it's too unbelievable to be in fiction. But that's sort of how I felt when I was trying to write it as just a straight mystery. So that's why I had this attachment to the story. And then I had so much information. I had all of my dad's files. I had all of those years that we had talked about the case, and 5,000 pages of the trial transcripts, an unpublished memoir from the district attorney who prosecuted the case that allowed me to get insight into what he was thinking about trial strategy. And the newspaper coverage was a little different back then. The kinds of details that they put in those stories, I don't think you see anymore. When you read in my book that somebody was wearing a black and white dress with a Peter Pan collar on the witness stands, that's true. I didn't just make that up. That was in the newspaper story for that day about when that witness testified. So I did have a lot of information that allowed me to write this story. And it is written in what they call a narrative or creative nonfiction, rather than just a straight journalistic style that you might see for a true crime book, because this really reads like a novel. And I wanted to use that, write in a narrative nonfiction, creative nonfiction, because when I read those trial transcripts and when I read that story really came alive to me. I mean, there was really an emotional impact, and I wanted readers to be able to experience that same emotional impact. But every fact in that book is true. You know, I didn't make anything up. Maybe I create in that style, narrative nonfiction, you can create a scene with little details like, oh, they're drinking coffee, or, you know, somebody was sitting up. Yeah, those things. But all of the dialogue, really, I learned from either interviews in the newspaper or what people testified to, because there was so much testimony, like I said, 5,000 pages, that I didn't put it all in the trial. Some of the things that people testified to and said happened, I created a scene somewhere else in the book. So yeah, I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, well, that was another question I had was about sort of, again, like the trial is from the 1950s. So like finding the material and getting access to some of those materials. So you talked about that. And some of these, some of the people who participated, many of them were public figures, right? But some of them you even chose to kind of give them pseudonyms or sort of create a composite of a number of people who were part of this. And so could you talk a little bit about those choices as well as a writer, and thinking about like how you're going to represent different people and why?
Right. Well, anybody who testified at the trial, and I used their words, they have their true name. One of the things was the detectives. There were a lot of detectives who worked on this case. And in Santa Barbara, especially at the beginning, because they investigated the disappearance. I have two detectives mainly working on this case. One is Charlie Thompson, and he was really the man who was able to discover the information that kind of broke the case. And there's a lot of information on Charlie. Other stories have been written about him in the Santa Barbara News Press. And I was able to interview his daughter. We connected on Facebook. There was a Facebook page. I grew up in Ventura, and somebody had brought up that case, and she said, "Oh, well, my father, Charlie Thompson, was one." And so I immediately sent her a personal message, and we had a number of interviews. She was able to talk to me about his personality. There's a scene in a bar with him talk because he got suspended, which also was an article I read in the paper. And his daughter gave me some insight into what he was doing about during the suspension, just as Olga disappeared. And that scene when the, in the bar, when he talks about going back to Chicago and thinking about that's all came, that's all true. That all came from his daughter. So then the other detective, Detective Jim Hansen, is a composite character. And so all the words and everything that Detective Hansen does in the story was done by a some detective on the Santa Barbara police force. It was just that there was just too many of them to have in the book. And so I enjoyed creating Detective Hansen, and he was, I used kind of some of the men that I grew up, their parents of some of my friends just growing up in the 1950s working class neighborhood. And he was very old school, and was kind of, I implied in there that he was a womanizer and had sort of 1950s attitudes. So anyway, he, Detective Hansen's personality is my creation, but the kinds of things that he did in the investigation are documented in that real detectives on the Santa Barbara Police Force did.
Yeah. And so this is because this is sort of also about you and yourself as a child, your mother and sister, a bit, right? It's not just about your father in that trial. Your mother and your sister are important sort of characters in the book. And your mother had a very sort of interesting job as well, especially during that time period. So could you talk a little bit about your mother and your sister and that sort of connection in this book?
Sure. My mother was a psychiatric social worker at Camarillo State Hospital, which at the time was called a mental institution. And she worked with people suffering from mental illness that had been institutionalized at this hospital. So throughout the book, there is some discussion about the difference between truly mentally ill people or maybe legal insanity and the killer in this story, who my father referred to as crazy, but did not really meet the legal definition of somebody who was legally insane. So, yeah, I used some of the information from that. Also, a story about one of my mother's former patients who was out of the hospital, and she continued to try to help, who got somewhat involved in our lives. And my sister, you know, when I was writing the book, I used to call her and ask her questions, and we would talk and laugh about things that happened in the family at that same time. Because this book, as strange as that may sound, there is humor in this book. In our family, it's, you know, what's going on there. When I said, you know, about Dave Barry meets Ann Rule in Fargo, there's also this kind of dark humor that's unintended by the people who have perpetuated this crime. But I did want to stick in a little bit something else about, I mentioned that my dad wrote a columns about our family and at this time. And so he saved a lot of the clippings of those columns all over the years. And he had, at the end of his life, he had a big black trash bag in his home office that he used to clip out columns or other stories and toss them into that trash bag. And so when my father passed away in 1987, I asked my, and this was before I'd ever even started on this book, I asked my mother if I could please have those, and she gave them all to me. So when I went through those, especially the columns, I got the columns all out and read those. I read during that time frame, you know, in the 1950s, 58, 59, at the time of the murder and the trial. What a gift that was, because my father had a very distinctive, dramatic way of speaking, and his voice just spoke to me from those yellowed clippings. That I really feel like I did get his quirky and outspoken personality right, and I had I think I do have two of his specific columns that I've actually put parts of in the book. And there is a couple of other family chapters that I was reminded of, oh, yes, that's what was going on in the family at that time. So that was able, how I was able to translate more effectively his personality, my mother's, because I did have that to rely on.
So before we get into the trial a little more, I also, another thing I found really interesting was your father was an atheist. And at this time you were like exploring many, many different religions, and there was some tension there. And especially again, in the 1950s, a really interesting sort of, you know, juxtaposition. So could you talk a little bit about that too? Because that was some really personal, but also at some points humorous pieces throughout there as well.
Right. Well, I always felt that we didn't actually fit in very well with the neighborhood, even though we were well-liked and I had a lot of friends and I know the neighbors liked my father. We were seen as sort of different, and we didn't go to church and most everybody else did. So I saw that as maybe if I would go to church, you know, we would fit in better. I was not deeply religious. I was looking at this more like hedging my bets, I guess, because I was hoping that God would protect me and save me. We had a couple of girls on the that were my friends from the neighborhood who were extremely religious. And one of them told me a number of times that my family was all going to go to hell because we didn't attend church. And so that bothered me. And so I would go to different churches, kind of searching for salvation and searching for acceptance. And especially once Olga was murdered, that did bother me a lot, but we had no, you know, that God maybe wasn't going to protect us as much as other people. I think there's a place in the book where I say, you know, I was worried about this. My grandmother said that called my father an atheist and that we needed to protect ourselves more, but we didn't even lock the door because we'd lost the key. So I was, you know, that was, I think, rather than being really looking for deep spiritual meaning in my life, I was looking to be more accepted and to hopefully find God that would protect me.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And so you know, tell us, and you tell us your story, but we also have the story of this, you know, what happened to Olga. And I mean, it's not a secret, because, you know, it's the book talks about how this is also the story of the last woman who was put to death in California and Californians' death row. And so can you talk a little bit about then, you know, as you're writing this and as you're thinking about this, how this story unfolds, right? How we go from this young woman disappearing to finding out that she has in fact been murdered.
Well, as I mentioned, Detective Charlie Thompson, well, we know from the beginning that the mother-in-law was harassing Elizabeth Duncan. Olga's mother-in-law, Frank's mother, was harassing Olga from the minute of her marriage. And so they were, the police were suspicious of her, but they had no information or evidence to arrest her or anything. And Charlie Thompson started thinking that, you know, she had this kind of sidekick, this 80-year-old woman, Emma Short, who was with Mrs. Duncan all the time. And Mrs. Duncan was 54 by the time, so Emma's quite a bit older. And Charlie felt if he could get Emma Short alone, that maybe he could find out what happened. And so that's what he was able to do. And that led also to finding the people that Elizabeth Duncan had hired to carry this out, because she really was just sort of a pathological liar, and she had promised them a lot of money to do this job for her, which she didn't have. And then she had to come up with some money. So she used some money that her son Frank had given, a check that her son Frank, and then when he wanted to know where the check came from, she made up the story that she was being blackmailed. Well, that really upset him. So he took her to the police station, and then everything started unraveling there, that they suddenly connected this and were able to figure out because of the who she said was blackmailing her, who might be involved with this. And then one of them was arrested. And then one of these men was arrested that she accused of blackmail. And he eventually spilled the beans and led authorities to the body that turned out to be in Ventura County. And he admitted that they'd killed her right there where they buried her. And so that's really how it all unraveled and led to the trial. And the other thing about being able to tell this story, so much of the details is, both the men that were hired to kill Olga testified in great detail about everything that happened. And this was before Miranda warnings. And so when they were arrested, you weren't appointed an attorney at that time until you were actually charged in court. So that when they were being interviewed, after they were arrested, they didn't have attorney's advice, and they ended up, you know, telling what happened without ever getting a promise of taking the death penalty off the table. So their lawyers, once they were finally appointed lawyers after their arraignments, they just tried the best they could to get the DA to take the death penalty off the table, which he wouldn't. But he did agree to trying them all separately. So then they agreed to testify against Mrs. Duncan, who claimed her innocence till the day she died. And the trial was just, you know, so many characters. She had asked many people to help her get rid of Olga. That was her term that she used. That, you know, did nothing. They didn't tell anybody. And there was a lot of drama in the trial of Mrs. Duncan calling everybody liars. And then the man who prosecuted the DA, he was the youngest DA that had been elected in Ventura County. And this was the beginning of his fourth term. And he was only like 42 years old at that point. He'd been elected like when he was 30. And so maybe his third term. But so anyway, he took this very personally. He really wanted to see these people punished. And it's very, you know, kind of just happenstance of what happened, because somewhere in the middle 60s, the Ventura DA's office discovered that all of the transcripts from the Duncan trial were missing. And they didn't know what happened to them. They would periodically search the office. And fast forward to 2000, 2001 approximately, I think. And the law firm that the DA, his name was Roy Gustafson, had founded in the 60s when he left the DA's office, was shutting down. It was going out of business. It was during a big recession at the time. And so there was and Roy Gustafson was long dead. He had died, I think it was about 7 or 8 years after the killers were executed. So there was an attorney working in that firm that had also grown up in Ventura, and he's a couple of years older than me, and he was a paper boy at the time. And he used to read the headline stories of this Duncan case as he folded the papers before he went out on his route. Well, he was an attorney at this point in this law firm, and he was cleaning out their law library. And up on a top shelf in that library, he discovered these bound transcripts. And opening up and looking at them, he knew exactly what they were, because he'd also been fascinated by the trial when he was a kid. So he contacted the DA's office. They got the transcripts back, and they were there when then I requested them a couple of years later. But also on that top shelf was the unpublished memoir that Roy Gustafson had written about the case. And so this lawyer, his name's Bob McSorley, he found that too. And that's how I was able to read that, to understand what this DA was thinking about the witnesses, about the killers, and most importantly, about some of the strategy he had from the trial. There's some pages in there where he is very worried that he's ruined his case by getting testimony on the record that maybe could have his case overturned. I got that all from his memoir. That was truly his worry and what his thought process.
So I mean, there's so much that happens, like you said at the beginning. You keep saying, like, there's so much that goes on that you're kind of, you read and you're like, really? And now this? So right,
like stranger than fiction,
right? Like yes, like she gets the marriage, annulled, right?
Or yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. We also find out that she has over 10, like a dozen husbands, or right? Like,
yes,
like
there's at least.
So were there things like, right, there's all these in here. So was there anything, or were there things that you either weren't sort of privy to as a 10-year-old, or that you didn't remember, that you're, as you're reading this, you're like, oh, like this is making it even more, you know, out there than I'd originally thought?
Yeah, right. Yes. I learned lots of details that I didn't know as a 10-year-old. And as you know, the memoir part is written as in first person, but the crime chapters are all written in third person. So that's not written from my 10-year-old point of view. That's written from my research and what happened, and also from my dad's point of view, because I have all the articles, you know, that he wrote about the trial and all of our discussions and his files. So, but yes, your question did. Was I surprised about some of the things? Yes, I didn't. I was surprised about all of the husbands to a certain extent, and all of the details. There's so much in there. I didn't have a lot of the husbands that testified in the penalty trial about what had happened, and I just couldn't put all of that in. I think one of the things also that was a little bit more information for me. My dad never thought that Frank Duncan, the son, oldest husband, and Mrs. Duncan's son, was involved in her killing. And but there's kind of this lore about the case in Ventura that a lot of people will say and believe that somehow he was part of the conspiracy. And my research pretty much, got rid of that idea. Roy Gustafson in his memoir says, that he really disliked Frank Duncan for a lot of reasons for leaving his wife alone. But he says, we should thank Frank Duncan. This case would have never been solved if he hadn't dragged his mother down to the police station when she was insisting that she'd been, she was being extorted, but she called it blackmail. That would never have happened without him. And so that kind of at least answered that question for me. Because when I started writing, I wasn't sure how I was going to handle that. There's also the prosecutor, Roy Gustafson, also put out a lot of ideas that there was incest going on between Frank and his mother, and that that's why she was so insistent that he couldn't be married to her. Again, my dad, when we talk, he never really believed that. And so the only testimony, well, there's two witnesses that testified, but there really wasn't any evidence that he ever put on. Mrs. Duncan's defense attorney felt like he was just sort of trying to really stir up interest, make it more sensational, and maybe poison the jury pool before they ever get there. So the way I've left it in the book is, here's the information I have. And I don't think that question is resolved, but I didn't really see any strong evidence that was what happened, that there was incest. I think she was a woman with no boundaries, absolutely no boundaries, and that she treated her son like he was the adult, and she tried to rely on him like she would a husband. So there was definitely emotional incest, even if there wasn't the actual physical.
And so do have any of these, another thing I was wondering, after reading it, and at the end you kind of give a little bit of information about sort of what happened to the people in this, but has Olga's family or Frank Duncan's family, has anyone really talked, whether it's on record or in any other way, about this trial and this experience after this? Or was it just like after it happened and after they were executed, this was something that people who were there might remember, but the rest is kind of lost to history?
Yeah, it is. But the interesting thing is I was contacted by two of Olga's relatives, descendants, after my book came out. They still live in Canada, and they heard about it. And the one is the daughter of Olga's brother. And she sent me this very nice email that, you can, through my website, you can contact me. And she went there and thanked me for writing this. She said, "You have no idea what a terrible effect this had on my family." And my grandparents, they were Olga's parents, were just devastated. My grandmother never got over it. You know, they just couldn't figure out. They said we just couldn't figure out how her husband could have left her alone and allowed this to happen. And yeah, that's something that came out. Frank Duncan had to know that his mother was threatening his wife. And I believe that he also, by the time of the trial, knew that his mother was guilty. I think that he just was standing by her side and testifying her in court about her, lying for her, because he was trying to save her from the death penalty. And but, you know, she was very, she says, I want to know what was going on in her life. What happened in this trial? And another one of her nieces, who never really knew the grandparents, she also contacted me about, before she read the book, about being very interested in reading the book. I also, the very first book launch event I had was at a bookstore in Santa Barbara. And it was in the newspaper up there and everything that I was going to be there speaking about this book. And so when we were waiting around to start, someone came over to me and she says, there's a woman over there. Elizabeth Duncan's niece, and she would like to talk to you. So I went over there and met her, Louise, and she told me, she had her friend with her, that, you know, she was a teenager at the time this all happened. And she talked a little bit about Elizabeth Duncan, who they called Aunt Hazel, because Elizabeth Duncan had just up and changed her name from Hazel to Elizabeth because she liked it better. And she just said, they had nothing good to say about her, said that she was always just dressed to the nines and that she was man crazy. And the other woman with her was her teenage friend who also knew her. And she says, yeah, she was awful. She was awful. So, and then I've heard from a couple, another one of Elizabeth Duncan's relatives. And I heard from Baldonado, one of the hired killers, Augustine Baldonado, his son got in touch with me. And so I have heard from some of these people since the book came out, and nobody was mad. You know, sometimes in true crime, people, the relatives are upset that you've written about their, you know, the killers that were their relatives. But the son, one of Maldonado's children, was actually one of the twins that is actually mentioned being born just after Olga disappeared. And he said that from the time he found out what his father had done, he wanted to know about it, as much about it as possible. And of course, his relatives weren't very interested in talking about it. It was something that nobody wanted to talk about. And so he kind of started off on an investigation on his own. And he told me he has all the trial transcripts. And he actually went to Sacramento to look at some of the exhibits from the appeals, and that he talked to people that before they died, some of the detectives. And so it was very interesting, because when we were talking, the way I got in touch with him, or he got in touch with me, is he called another bookstore where I was doing a launch and said, people wanted to talk to me, and they said, well, we can't give your information, but leave your number and we'll give it to her. So I thought about it for a while, and before I called him, and we both admitted that we were a little concerned that each other might be mad. I said, I was a little worried about calling you because I thought you would be angry that I had written about your father. And he said, well, I was afraid that you would be angry at me for being the son of someone who had committed this terrible crime. So we talked for quite a while. It's a good discussion.
So this book came out in October, and you talked a bit about book launches. Are there other things that are coming up that you are working on with this book at all? Or,
well, my agent is busy negotiating film rights, so I think that is coming up. I really can't say anything more about that. Yes, I have on my website, I think that it is up there now. If not, it should be. The website is, but there's going to be a page for book clubs. I've done a lot of book clubs lately. And so I have put up there, if you have a book club that's read the book and you're interested in me in answering questions and talking about my book, that I'm willing to do Zoom book club meetings where, you know, people can ask me some questions for 45 minutes or an hour. I just have other, I've been doing some podcasts. I've done quite a few on true crime. I did another one on Tuesday. And so those are in the works. Also, I have some speaking engagements. This is in Ventura County that I'm going to. One's a Rotary Club, and one is a book club at a Leisure World community. And then I'm hoping to schedule something at the library. So yeah, I'm doing quite a few things. It seems like every week that there's something that I do, but. You know, I am in California, and it's difficult to go speak at bookstores in other parts of the country. So that's why I put up with the book club that I'd be happy to do that. I also have an author Facebook page, Deborah Holt Lark, an author on Facebook, that I posted a number of my father's old columns that didn't really have anything to do with it. But people, that's kind of been a big hit. People have really enjoyed reading his columns, and I intend to continue doing that. And there's a lot of things on my website, DeborahLarkin.com also.
So I'll ask you my one usual final question usually is, so this is your first book. So is there anything else that you can talk about that you want to talk about that you're working on now? Like, have you dipped your toe in and you're done, or are you off your next adventure?
Well, I want to be off on my next adventure. I would say I felt so fortunate that Pegasus was, willing to publish my book, a first-time author, a woman of a certain age with no platform. And so I'm happy that this book is doing well. And I'm hoping after this that I will finally write that fiction book. I want to write a mystery this time. I would not be able to write another true crime book because, you know, I'm in a unique position that I have had all of this information, all of this material to research that I could write this true crime. Yeah, but hopefully my next book will be a mystery, and I want to get started on it as soon as possible.
Awesome. Well, Debbie, thanks for talking with me again. This was Deborah Holt Lark-in, the author of A Lovely Girl. Thanks for talking with me for New Books in Popular Culture.
Well, and thanks for having me on the program. I enjoyed it.